And welcome to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. We've got a great show for you today, so stay tuned. We're going to start off with some music, and we got some events to talk about in the second half hour at around 11:30. We have a guest coming to join us from Centre-Pôle Roulant. And of course, Centre-Pôle Roulant is this great organization in Montreal that does a Meals on Wheels program, but also runs a farm in Centreville, and I believe also has a rooftop garden somewhere in Montreal. And all of the food they produce is organic, and it's a great ecological agricultural project in the local area. So Melanie is going to come in and talk to us about that from Centre-Pôle Roulant. So stay tuned for that. Like I said, that's going to be coming up in the second half hour. We're going to have Melanie Godel here from Centre-Pôle Roulant live in the studio. And we're going to start off with some music from an album that actually does feature some stuff, some themes about agriculture. There was a documentary film made in the 70s called The Secret Life of Plants that was based on the book. I can't remember who the authors were of that book. But Stevie Wonder did the whole soundtrack for that film. I think he really liked that book as well. And there's a couple of really great songs from that soundtrack. And this is one of them, which is called Same Old Story.
Kind nature's door, a life known by a few. And those who knew that shared their knowledge, few or cared about what that could do. For most felt it was mad to that plants thought, felt, and moved quite like we. But with instruments both would devise, would take science itself by surprise. So on we go. What will it take for heaven's sake for those who find what's real too hard to believe in? It's that same old story again. Born of slaves who died soon to realize the need his life would be. Selflessly he gave his wisdom to the way where first no minds would see. He said if farmland was to be we must plant crops to replenish it. But it took him persuasion and test to convince them Harbor's way was best. So on we go. Heaven's sake those who find what's real too hard to believe in. It's that same old story again.
And that was a tune by Stevie Wonder from the Secret Life of Plants album, CD. And that was a song written about George Washington Carver, primarily. And he was an American agricultural scientist and inventor who promoted alternative crops to cotton and methods to prevent soil depletion. And he was a black man. And he was born in 1864, died in 1943. And he was, I think, you know, one of the pioneers in American agriculture in terms of, you know, changing agricultural techniques. He wanted poor farmers to grow other crops such as peanuts and sweet potatoes as a source of their own food to improve their quality of life. And so he also had these practical bulletins for farmers, and they contained 105 food recipes using peanuts. And he was also a leader in promoting environmentalism. You know, he basically said that, you know, you've got to plant cover crops to basically restore the soil's fertility. And I think he was somebody who would have been, had he lived long enough, a supporter of organic agriculture and so on. So yeah, so very interesting history of a man in the U.S., George Washington Carver. And of course, Stevie Wonder wrote that great song, Same Old Story, for the Secret Life of Plants soundtrack album. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is Ryan Young. And as I said, in our second half hour, around 11:30, we're going to have our guest, Melanie Godel from the Centropole organization. She's going to be coming in to talk about Centropole's work, especially their work involving organic agriculture and that kind of thing. Of course, many people know Centropole because of the cafe, and they are, or they were connected at one time. I don't know if they're still connected. Maybe we'll ask Melanie that. But the organization is called Centropole Roulant, and they do all kinds of things. If you go to their website, you'll find out a lot of information about them, and their website is centropoleroulant.org. And they are a membership-based organization. They are a community organization working to help the local community. They have organic baskets. They have frozen meals. They have community workshops. They have a bike shop. They have a farmer's market. There's a lot going on. So we're going to find out more about that from Melanie in the second half hour. For now, we're going to go to an interview that was done on Radio EcoShock. Radio EcoShock, we often feature here on Ecolibrium. It's an environmental radio show that comes out of Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC. And it is led by Alex Smith, who's been doing it for many, many years. And his focus on Radio EcoShock is really climate change, or the climate change emergency. And recently he interviewed Dr. Ryan Driscoll Tate about China's coal mines. And often lately, I think we're getting the impression that China is being more responsible environmentally maybe than the U.S., or that they're turning away from coal, but this is far from the truth. And this interview shed some light on that. So this is Alex Smith interview. We're going to play part of it, not probably the whole thing, but this is Alex Smith's interview with Dr. Ryan Driscoll Tate about China's energy crisis and its new coal mines.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
According to NOAA, the highly dangerous global warming gas methane just hit an all-time high of 1,908 parts per billion in May of 2022. Methane grew faster last year than ever before. Now we get a new report saying, quote, China's new coal mines could raise global methane emissions by 10%. The story comes from research analyst Ryan Driscoll Tate for the tracking group Global Energy Monitor. Dr. Ryan Driscoll Tate, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Alex. Great to be here.
For most listeners, there's a lot of shocking new information in your latest report on coal mining in China. For example, the storyline reaching the West was that China was cutting back on coal. They needed to control that deadly smog infesting cities and whole parts of the country. What happened to that?
Well, yeah, so at the end of, kind of in the middle of last year, China underwent a coal shortage, a domestic energy crisis of their own. And so you started seeing, essentially, I mean, in 17 provinces, so in large parts of the country, but particularly in the Northeast, I mean, they were having blackouts and brownouts, and I mean, you were having traffic lights that weren't working. And so the response to that was to increase their coal production and to increase their supply. And so they did that quite dramatically and quite quickly at the end of last year, where they essentially ramped up production, both increasing production at existing mines, but also accelerating the speed at which they were opening up new mines. And the result of that was just sort of a surge of activity. So last year, China hit their record coal production of about 4 billion tons. And so that's one of the things that I think that was happening domestically that was shifting the situation.
The second shocker is the amount of methane coming from coal mining operations around the world. We expect methane from fracking and leaky natural gas systems, but why is coal mining a significant source of it?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I mean, as far as the mining industry is concerned, you know, there's nothing new about coal mine methane. I mean, they've been dealing with this literally since mining began, and this is the reason you have explosions underground and that mining itself is sort of considered dangerous work. And a lot, I mean, even if you go back to early industrialization, a lot of the earliest inventions that were made were related to methane. You know, how do you take a flame underground to see it before electricity if you have to worry about an explosive gas? So the mining industry has worried about this a great deal, and they've usually understood it predominantly as a safety issue, which is that it's a hazard to workers and to the workplace. And so the outcome of that is basically what the mining industry has done is use degasification systems and ventilation systems in order to try to basically get the methane out of the mine as quickly as they can. And that basically enables a safer work environment so that mining can happen without having to worry about explosions. The problem, though, is where does the methane go when they get it out of the mine? Well, effectively, it just gets pumped into the atmosphere most often or ventilated out, you know, like literally like a chimney. So that's posed a different issue, which is that methane is also, you know, the second biggest contributor to global warming next to carbon dioxide. And so every time these mining activities are ongoing and also after they're done, if they're not properly sealed after mining is done, they continue to leak methane for decades. And so this is kind of the issue that we're talking about here is that for a long time, we've kind of thought of methane as predominantly an oil and gas industry issue, but it's important to realize that mining is actually also a major contributor. And in some places, you know, mining is actually producing more methane than oil or gas when you look at those two sectors.
I was going to ask you about that. How much methane comes from coal mining? Is it really significant in terms of global warming?
Well, you know, that's the thing is that there's so much variance in people's understanding about what those mine methane assessments are. So, for example, I mean, you know, the US EPA we'll say the annual methane emissions from coal mining globally is about 34 million tons of CH, you know, of methane. But other academic studies have said it's as high as 86. To put that in comparison, you know, I think that, you know, the oil and gas industry is producing, 30 to 40 million tons each. So, you know, no matter where it lands on that spectrum between 30 and 80, it's producing comparable amounts to the oil and gas industries. So we actually had done a study back in March where we used tracked all the coal mines around the world and estimated what their methane emissions would be based on all kinds of data that we had about those, the rank of the coal that they're mining, how deep the mines are, the amount that those mines produce, you know, what the methane content in those coal seams are likely to be. And we came up with about 52 million tons, which is actually higher than oil and gas, when you take them separately.
This is something I don't understand. Why would a deeper mine produce more methane than a shallower one or even an open pit mine?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. It just has to do with the geological formation of the coal seams, and you have higher methane content. Basically, the methane content is greater with greater pressure, and so the deeper the rock and the deeper the strata and the coal is part of the process called coalification in geology, and so as a result of that, there's just higher methane content in the lower seams. And so as a result of that, underground mines are particularly gassy in certain places. But it's not to say that, you know, surface mining is necessarily any better. When they mine at the surface and they're closer to the surface, some of those coal mines actually do go very deep, and they do hit some gassy coal pockets. And the other thing is, too, it's just a larger exposed area. So you just have these you can have these kind of mile-wide open-pit coal mines in which they're also releasing a lot of methane as well.
New Science warns the United Nations and institutions operate on methane figures that are, quote, severely underestimated, end quote. According to Carbon Brief, real methane from fossil fuels could be 20 to 40% higher than we have been told. What have you heard about that, and could your own numbers in the new GEM briefing be underestimates as well?
You know, I think it's really important, to take this into consideration because, you know, our concern has been that, and not just ours, but a lot of academic studies have been pointing this way as well, which is that we, in terms of coal mining, that we have been underestimating methane emissions. We know for a fact that they're underreported, and so when you have all the, you know, various countries report their coal mining methane at, you know, into their national inventories, that those actually don't add up to the amount of emissions that we know are coming from mining based on atmospheric science. So there's a gap here, and so one of the things that we know that it is being underreported. Part of the reason is just because there's not a lot of transparency in actual regulations requiring any kind of monitoring of methane from mining in many parts of the world. And so what you end up getting is mines that are producing, and we don't really know how much methane they're emitting at all because no one's actually measuring it. And so there's no way of being certain. So, you know, we look at estimates. Others use estimates. There's a recent move towards satellite data, for example, of using satellites to kind of track methane hotspots around the world. And what that satellite information has shown is that there's a lot of, you know, hotspots popping up in places where we wouldn't expect them. So coal mining regions where you'll have this huge kind of cloud of methane and is this release, and it's not clearly understood where that's coming from because, you know, none of the mining companies or mines on the ground seem to have or will claim any responsibility for it. So it becomes very difficult to know precisely how much is coming out. With our study, I would say that, you know, this is actually to get back to an issue around surface mining. One of the things those satellite data has shown is that a lot of times surface mines are actually releasing more methane than what people thought, and these kind of hotspots are popping up around surface mines. And so that is actually really significant because if surface coal mines are releasing more methane than what people have presumed, then pretty much every assessment that's used some kind of estimate of, you know, that surface mines are emitting less than underground mines is going to be lower. So it might throw all the assessments off if that's the case. So I think it just calls for more transparency and reporting on what's actually happening on the ground.
So let's talk for a minute about attempts at solutions. Coal miners, as you point out, know they have to get that methane gas out of there, otherwise it could blow up. So the industry blasts air in and methane-laden air out. That arrives at the surface as a mix called ventilation air methane. Can that methane be captured and at least used as energy and converted into the less powerful warming gas, carbon dioxide?
Yeah, there's a few things they can do. One issue I would point out is that utilization of that methane, so actually using that methane, say, like at a gas plant or something, is actually fairly rare around the world. So there's, the Global Methane Initiative is a group that actually kind of tracks these kinds of projects. And I think around the world, there's only about 150 or 160 active, mine methane utilization projects. Part of that's just a logistical nightmare, I think, is that as far as the mining industry is concerned, methane is waste, right? They want to get the methane out of the ground as quickly as possible because it interferes with what they really want to do, which is to mine coal. So they don't necessarily view it as sort of a commercial product or a commercial enterprise. And so in order to do that, they have to team up with a gas company effectively, and they have to build the correct infrastructure to make that work. And it can be incredibly tricky to do that. And I think it's been one of the reasons why, inexpensive, I think it's been one of the reasons why you just haven't seen that be as common. The other things they can do is, yeah, they can flare the methane, which would then convert it into CO2 by burning it. And there's a few other things that they could try, but it's actually none of those things are standard. So most of the time, especially coming from ventilation systems, they call them VAM emissions. Most of the time, that's just being released directly into the atmosphere. There isn't sort of a industry standard of capture and use or flaring.
Well, what we really need is a technology to capture mine methane and store it away harmlessly somewhere for centuries. Have you heard about any research on that?
I'm sure there's research on capture. I don't know. Again, I don't know how well that those projects have actually been implemented. And it's also one of those things as well that it's even when you look at the amount of these projects around the world, it's just not the industry has to have an incentive, I think, in order to want to do that, either a regulation or some kind of economic incentive. And without those, they literally will view it the same way. They kind of view methane in a similar way in which they view rock and other minerals that they find in the coal. It's a waste product that they want to dispose of quickly.
Well, your new briefing tracks this all very well. In 2015, the government of China announced a policy of decapacity. They signaled a wind down of coal use, including a 3-year cap on coal production. But that changed just a year later. Why did the government bring back more coal?
Yeah, I mean, so the decapacity policy is something they've been working on for, 5 to 10 years. And effectively, China had at one point, in around 2010, they had around, I think, over 10,000 coal mines in China, and most of those mines are what they sometimes call village mines, just to mean that they're very small, local coal mines that don't mine very much. And, the government realized that there was a lot of essentially what they would consider waste and inefficiencies in the sector. So what they wanted to do was to close a lot of coal mines, to get rid of a lot of the excess capacity, and then to consolidate operations into some of their larger coal-producing provinces like Inner Mongolia and Shaanxi. And so that's been ongoing for about 10 years. And they've actually made huge progress in doing that. And that's something we actually do talk about in the report is the way in which they actually have decreased capacity over time. The change, the about-face that we saw is really just a reaction to, I think, two things. One is what happened domestically last year. It was this kind of short-term crunch, and they needed to bring a lot of new mines back into operation as quickly as they can and accelerate production at mine projects that were ongoing. The other thing is that you've had some international incidences happen recently that's actually really encouraged China to basically double down on what they term energy security and sort of self-reliance and energy independence. So, those being, first of all, there was the trade row that they got into with Australia over the origins of COVID. And that was, and Australia is actually, the second largest exporter, maybe the largest exporter of coal in the world. The other is Indonesia, which is, again, the other large exporter of coal in the world. They also, Indonesia imposed an export ban temporarily because of their own coal shortages, so they were no longer exporting to China. And then, the major country that was sort of making a play sort of on the China coal market for imports right before the start of this year was Russia. And so after the war in Ukraine began, that too kind of created an incentive, I think, for China to sort of rely on their own domestic resources and to sort of boost their own coal supply at home. So they are doing this actively now this coming year. They have plans to boost capacity about 300 million tons. They have various, they want to build a stockpile of coal, about 600 million tons. And just to put that in perspective, these are not small figures. China produces about 4 billion tons of coal a year. The second largest producer of coal is India, which produces about 700 million. So that's about 5 to 6 times more that China is actually producing every year. And so when China is going to stockpile about 600 million tons and ramp up capacity by 300 million tons, these are actually very large figures in terms of the global industry. So that's been, I think those are the kind of the constellation of reasons for China's recent push.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest research analyst, Dr. Ryan Driscoll-Tate from Global Energy Monitor. We're talking about a wave of methane coming from expanding Chinese coal mining. At climate conferences, as recently as Glasgow, December 2021, China assured the world it would cut back massive emissions from its coal burning and reach its climate goals. But then the country experienced, as you said, an apparent energy crisis. What happened there?
I think that the energy crisis had a lot of different factors going into it. Some of it had to do with weather incidences. Some of it had to do with constraints on some of the companies at certain times, dwindling of stockpiles and things like that. I do think that, it's one of the abilities that China has, which is to effectively, they can respond quite quickly, which is what they were able to do last year. I mean, the amount of new capacity and new production that they were able to bring online effectively within a matter of months, it's sort of, I'm not sure there's any other country that can move in that kind of direction as quickly as what China was able to do. It does create questions about some of the commitments that were made. And I think that what I would point out is a lot of times the commitments are being made around consumption and they're made around effectively coal power. So mining actually is kind of a loophole in all of this. I mean, none of the commitments that they're making are necessarily being broken by mining more coal, because a lot of it's being measured not based on the supply side, but on the demand side. So how much coal they're actually burning, or whether they're investing in coal plants abroad. And so I think that in some ways, boosting coal production in the short term, it has a potential because of the methane emissions, as we talk about, of jeopardizing some of those short-term targets, climate targets. But it's also not really doing anything that's different from what they're saying they're going to do, which is effectively phase down coal consumption after 2025 and into 2030.
And how realistic are these expansion plans? Are some new coal plants already under construction? Where are they? Do you expect this to really happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they will meet the expansion that they've announced. I mean, that China, even before China made the announcement that they were going to be ramping up production this year, or ramping up capacity this year, 300 million tons, we had already tracked that they had about 500 million tons kind of in the system already under works. So, I mean, they only have to really bring on part of that, just over half of that, and they'll be all set. So there's no reason that they wouldn't be able to mine that amount of coal. It's interesting because there are countries where that's not true, where they would like to increase production in certain ways, but they struggle at actually making it come into fruition. China is not one of those countries. They can make it come into fruition, absolutely. And I think it's just because of the consolidation and state-owned, reality of those enterprises that they're able to move quite quickly.
Okay, suppose these new coal operations come online in the next few years. What could that mean for methane going into the atmosphere? Do we know?
Yeah, so this is one of the issues that we've tried to talk about in this report. It's just to say, first of all, that mining more coal actually is sort of a climate problem. It's not just about burning of the coal itself, but even before it gets to a power plant, it has released methane into the atmosphere, presuming that there weren't, you know, all kinds of precautions taken beforehand, which we don't always have evidence that there are. So what we pointed out was just at the end of last year alone, when they did that ramp up of production and they hit that new target, just the ramp up, so not their total output, but just the ramp up released an extra, 2.5 million tons of methane.
And that was an excerpt of an interview from Radio EcoShock, which comes out of Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC. It was an interview with Ryan Driscoll Tate, or Dr. Ryan Driscoll Tate, who has a PhD from Rutgers University in energy and environmental history, and he is a climate and coal analyst. And he was talking about China's coal industry and new coal plants. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. And we're now in our second half hour. And our live in studio guest is with us now, and that's Melanie Godel, who is the fundraising and communications manager at Centre Paul Roulant. And Centre Paul Roulant, of course, as I said in the introduction to the show, is a great organization promoting organic agriculture, bringing young people and seniors together. You're going to explain to me more about it, but basically started around the core of a Meals on Wheels program for seniors. So how are you doing today, Melanie?
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. I guess maybe I'll first ask you how you got involved with Centre Paul Roulant.
Sure. So I've been working at the Roulant now for just over 4.5 years. And I was living in the neighborhood. I moved to the area and was looking for work and heard about the Roulant through somebody I knew who worked there part-time and then another person who volunteered in the bike shop. And I was like, what is this place? It sounds really interesting. I looked at the website. It was super in line with my personal values. I had worked at nonprofits before. And so the first day I handed in my resume, it was actually one of their major community events, the annual general meeting. And I was like, this is an AGM. What's going on here? Because it was just a huge community celebration. It was packed full of people having conversations, talking about the Roulant. And it was just incredible. So luckily I landed the job and I'm still there.
Nice, nice. That's great. So describe for me what Centre Paul Roulant is.
Sure. Yeah. So it's a community organization that I would say has one foot in the social services and one foot in social change. So like you said in the introduction, it started from a Meals on Wheels organization. Some young people had this idea. They saw the need from their neighbors, actually, of people in need of a meal delivery service. Either they had some sort of loss of mobility, some sort of health challenge that prevented them from accessing food. So, the name, people might recognize the name Centre Paul from the Centre Paul Café. So it was actually started.
Which is connected still?
It's historically connected. So it started in the café's kitchen from some of their leftovers. And it ended up being its own community organization. We got a new space, and since then there's no affiliation, but the history is there, rooted in that kitchen.
And then, of course, there for a while, I don't know if it still exists, there was Centre Paul Coffee, which you could buy.
Yeah.
And that was connected at that time?
Basically, the owners of the cafe kind of branched off in different directions. And one of the original owners, founders of the cafe, started a coffee roastery, which has since closed down. But yeah, so the name is all across Montreal, since the 60s.
Nice. Because, yeah, we had him on the show. I can't remember his name, but the person who ran the roastery.
James Sulkin.
Yeah, James Sulkin. Yeah, yeah. And then, one of the reasons that I've always been fascinated by Centre Paul Roulant, because I'm from St. Anne de Bellevue, is that you have a farm in Senneville,
right.
An organic farm. So what's the history of that?
So I would say it started quite small. So the deliveries, meal deliveries, cooking warm meals 5 days a week for people in need. That was happening for many, many years. And, somewhere along the way, somebody had the idea, what if we grew some ingredients for these meals that we're making? We want to be able to integrate healthy local ingredients. So it started with just small little bins of vegetables on the sidewalk or on the rooftop. It evolved into having a space actually with McGill, in collaboration with McGill. And in 2012, we ended up founding the farm in Senville. So, you know, it's all connected to the food cycle. The Meals on Wheels really being focused on food distribution and access to food for, you know, more marginalized populations, populations that have a more difficult time accessing good food. And, you know, on the other end of that, we have the actual growth and production of ingredients that go in those meals. So it's a cycle, and we really wanted to make sure that we are addressing the full cycle of food production, distribution.
Nice. And you also have a rooftop garden,
we
right?
do, exactly. So when we acquired the building that we have now on Roy Street, we reinforced the building in order to have a rooftop garden. That's really, it's a green space in the middle of, you know, an urban space, and it's an educational space. So with these agricultural spaces, both the urban and the peri-urban, the farm in Senville, the idea is that some of the ingredients end up in the Meals on Wheels service, but we also have other ways of making it accessible to the community. In previous years, we've had a CSA basket model. Now it is distribution to health and educational institutions. We have a couple of partnerships that sprung up during the pandemic. So people that we might not otherwise have access to, who are in need of, you know, fresh, healthy vegetables, you know, something a little nicer quality than what's left over in the food bank or at Moisson Montréal. So we have a partnership with Partage and Solidarité that distributes around the plateau and beyond, and then the Native Friendship Center of Montreal.
Wow, that's fabulous. And it must be a cool place to hang out, the rooftop garden.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, lots of people interested in signing up for the volunteer shifts that we have there. Very, very popular. And it's a great place to learn as well. So, you know, anybody interested in getting their hands dirty, it's a great starting point. You're stewarded along the process of, you know, here are certain garden tasks that you need to do, sure, but we really make sure it's a space for learning, space where everybody feels welcome and they can make connections with one another.
And rooftops, I guess, because it gets so hot up there, they need a lot of water, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. There's a pretty strict watering schedule. We do have, so part of it is the rooftop garden, but then we also have a wooden terrace where we have containers, and they're actually self-watering containers.
Oh, right.
So that is one of the pieces of education that we do around urban gardening, is teaching people, well, how can you yourself have a garden and make it a sustainable? So it's a system first developed by Alternatives Montreal, where you essentially just have sort of a false bottom in a bin that you can fill up with water, and the water gets sucked up through the soil through osmosis as it dries. So it's able to stay wet for longer, 2 days about.
Well, that's great. And so in terms of what makes the organization tick, obviously it's the people, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that structure look like? Or maybe you have some anecdotes about that, because you were saying that, you know, you were so amazed that they were having an AGM.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're sort of driven by what we call the 9 core principles of engagement. And number one on that list is people as gifts. So it's really a way of working where anybody who comes in contact with the organization is just welcomed, is treated as an equal, is treated as a gift. They have something to contribute, something to bring in the work of community building, in the work of food security, in the work of social inclusion. So it's, you know, really taking a holistic approach. It's not just addressing food security. People are hungry, let's feed them. It's saying, what are the ways we can make people feel like they're actually part of a community? And all of the spin-off benefits of that community building, of people feeling connected. You know, when people feel a sense of inclusion, they're part of a community. They're actually feeling, you know, more capable of having a sense of autonomy after that. So whether it's autonomy in their ability to feed themselves and maintain a healthy lifestyle, or a sense of autonomy in terms of going out in the world and learning about things and seeking what they're interested in. And, you know, that all can accumulate to this greater vision that we have of social change.
Nice. And I guess you also have workshops. I mean, so I guess some of these things were affected by the COVID pandemic, but at least before the pandemic, or maybe after, You teach elderly people how to cook. Is that true? Or
so there's a number of things. Yeah, a lot of it was affected by the pandemic, I would say. We used to do a lot more kitchen workshops, food preservation, even agricultural workshops. After a survey that we did, I think in 2019, in combination with some of the effects of the pandemic, we actually realized that one of the best spaces for learning instead of just one-off workshops is actually through our volunteer engagement. So shifts in the urban gardens at the farm. So we've incorporated a lot more educational elements into those. And we've also shifted focus to other community organizations, schools, groups of youth. In fact, we have a group of youth today, right this very moment at the farm, learning all about the food cycle. And they've been to the urban gardens. They've now been to the farm. It's really giving them a whole perspective on what that looks like. So education is definitely a foundation of the work that we're doing, and we're finding different ways of doing it. I could speak more actually about the future of the farm, which is the agro-educational center. I don't know if you've heard of
it. I have heard a little bit about it, yeah. But yeah, tell me what the project is. Yeah.
Well, this is the vision that we have for the farm. And actually last year we signed a 26-year lease for the land so that we could actually look further into the future of building infrastructure on the farm that allows us to not only grow vegetables, but to welcome groups, make the land more accessible to people with all levels of mobility. So just having the right infrastructure, essentially. It's a 3-acre plot of land. There's not a lot there right now. There is a porta potty. There is some electricity put in last year. Luckily, we've got Wi-Fi for the farmers to do their work. But the installations there, the sort of infrastructure, is pretty light. So, you know, we don't even have a rain shelter necessarily aside from the greenhouses. So actually creating the space and the spaces where we can more intentionally bring the community to the farm to see and to experience what is, you know, local organic agriculture and what is its place in our food cycle, in our food systems.
Nice, nice. So that would be, I guess, some sort of building that would be like a, that would house all of that educational side. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So educational spaces,
a kitchen, maybe.
Kitchen, exactly. Even just some more practical storage space for our farmers, and office spaces, those kinds of things. So it's really on our radar at the moment. It's something that we're looking to do in the coming years, and was identified in our strategic plan, our last strategic plan.
Nice. And then I also have the, what is it called? It's the old Hotel Dieu Hospital, right?
That's right, yeah.
There was it's owned by the City of Montreal, but you have some gardens going on there as well.
That's right. So our latest addition to our urban agriculture sites is what we call the Jardin de la Cité des Hospitalières. So this historic site on Despins, it's actually walled off. It's surrounded by a stone wall. You've probably seen it before, hanging out in Genmas Park, looking down from the mountain. But not a lot of people actually know what's behind there. And there's actually an orchard, as we were talking about earlier, and there is a garden. And so we operate, or we essentially manage one of those gardens. So that was a partnership that came about 2 years ago. And so we harvest the vegetables from that garden, distribute it to some of our partners, incorporate it into the Meals on Wheels service, and have volunteers coming in. It's really a wonderful, like, just something so serene about the space. It really is an oasis within the city.
Hmm. And I know also that you have a partnership or a project called Les Fruits Défendus.
Mm-hmm, yes.
And so can you describe that a bit?
Yeah. So the Roulant, especially since its inception, was really about supporting young people with ideas. And so part of that is the collectives we call volunteer-led collectives who run a project that is related to the food cycle and related to the Roulant's mission, but it's completely run by volunteers. So Les Fruits Défendus is one of those collectives. They 100% operate their own volunteer base. They have a database that they created themselves. They operate their own budget. And throughout the growing season, they go around, they have a database of fruit tree owners, urban fruit tree owners, who are often people who maybe have more fruit than they can handle. They're not either able to cultivate the fruit trees, they don't have the know-how, or there's just too much. So they get in touch with Les Fruits Défendus, and they mobilize volunteers to go pick that fruit. And they have a model of thirds. One third goes to the tree owner, one third goes to the volunteers who picked the fruit, and one third goes to a community organization. Often Saint-Tropez-le-Grand, but they have partners across the island of Montreal. So
nice.
It's a really great project. And actually, they were some of the first ones to have access to the Jardin de la Cité,
the orchard
behind.
There.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Wow. Which I guess has apple trees.
Yep.
Plum trees.
There's apple trees. There's one pear tree, I think, okay. And there are some grapes, things like that.
Yeah. Okay, nice. If people are interested in getting involved in Saint-Tropez-le-Roulant, is it easy? Is it how would they go about doing it?
Super, super easy. Basically, we have no minimum requirement for engagement. If you want to become a volunteer, if you want to join one of the collectives, you can engage to the degree that you seek. If you have a couple of hours a week and you want to come every week, that's great. If you have, a couple of free days over the course of a semester, there's really no minimum or maximum. And to become a volunteer means that you have access to all kinds of volunteering, from the Meals on Wheels service, that's cooking in the kitchen, delivering meals, so being in contact with seniors in your community, people with a loss of autonomy, and all the way to the gardens, to the farm. So right now, the need is there, in particular for the farm. There's 2 days a week, Tuesdays and Wednesdays, where we have volunteer shifts at the farm. We provide carpooling options. It's even really easy to get to St. Anne by the EXO train, now only $3.50.
Right.
And then to, a little bike ride down Senneville Road to the farm.
Nice.
So to become a volunteer, you can just visit the Saint-Tropez-le-Roulant website, saint-tropez-le-roulant.org, and click the volunteer button. There's a way to sign up. We do a welcome session, what we call, so that you can get a bit of an orientation all about the Roulant's various programs, the mission, also a chance to just interact and meet other people who are becoming volunteers, because that is a big part of what it means to be a volunteer, is to also interact with other volunteers and meet people. So the next welcome session is actually tomorrow at 11 a.m. So if anybody's really a go-getter right now, they could sign up for that info session. Otherwise, we have a few in the coming week.
And that's in your building on Roy, right?
We did do for a short time virtual info sessions, but a number of them are back to in-person.
And my other question is, I guess, just even from your personal perspective, mm-hmm. is Montreal like a really great place in terms of urban agriculture? It seems to me that there's always new things going on, and Saint-Tropez-le-Roulant is kind of in the middle of it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot going on, that's for sure. So, a good example is that there were a couple events for Cultiver Montréal, and Cultiver Montréal is one of those organizations that connects various urban agriculture projects. We'll do events, speaker series, things like that. I think they had a film series recently as well. So there's lots of different projects going on. And sometimes, our gardens are full. There's a lot of volunteer interest. So there is actually a blog post on our website as well that describes other organizations that could benefit from volunteer support. If you're more keen on sticking closer to the city and, you're not able to access some of those shifts. Tons of opportunities out there.
Nice. Do you find that the city administration, like the Montreal City Administration, are they more positive than they used to be? Or is there a shift going on in terms of their willingness to get involved and to even fund projects? Or,
I would say I think so. We do our best as an organization to build relationships, and that includes the city of Montreal, building relationships with people who do have their finger on the pulse or are looking at ways to improve our city. So we do what we can to have conversation with them that share what our reality is and what our observations are about the benefits of urban agriculture. And a big part of growing that vision is getting other people on board so they can also advocate for those things. So that's our goal, really, when we're building relationships with the city, with funders, even with volunteers, is to try to transform anybody who comes into contact with the organization into an advocate for social change.
Hmm. And you know, I still have this very strong criticism of the type of food that they serve in hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like we're on the cusp, maybe, of an attempt to integrate more of this fresh, maybe mm-hmm. even organic food into hospital menus.
I would say that there is more awareness around who has access to healthy, local, organic ingredients. And it might be flashy and nice looking for a farm to have CSA baskets, but often they're out of reach for a lot of people, like you say, who might be accessing or these institution services. It's for the families who can afford it or who are able to displace themselves to go pick them up. So the more we can bring food, good food, to the doorstep of the people who need it. And that's, you know, a big part of what the Meals on Wheels does, is that we're delivering straight to the doorstep of somebody in need. So this is just another example of that, of, you know, the more we can actually, you know, behind the scenes, even in this case, bring the good ingredients to those institutions so that they can incorporate it, the more we're also seeding change within those institutions.
Nice. And in terms of your actual staff, are you a large staff? Or is there a lot of people that work for Central Port Royal?
It's 20 to 30, depending on the season. So right now, at the height of the agricultural season, we have more interns, more seasonal employees, you know, we're getting their hands dirty in the fields, in the gardens. In the off season, you know, the Meals on Wheels still keeps going. The volunteer programs still keep going all year round. And even if it's the off season for agriculture, we're still planning ahead. But the team often shrinks in the winter time. But we have about 1,500 plus volunteers every year. So in comparison to the people doing the work on the day-to-day basis and the people supporting the mission all year round, like, we could not do the work that we do without the incredible volunteer community.
Yeah. And in terms of people that might be philanthropists or people that that like to support organizations mm-hmm. like you, how do you maintain that relationship or
just
do you have
the same as anybody else? Like, really, anybody who donates to the Roulant is a member of the community. We really treat everybody the same.
And it is a charity.
It is a charity, exactly. Yeah. So we provide tax receipts. One of the best ways to support an organization like this, any organization really, is being a monthly donor, because that provides reliable, consistent funding. It allows organizations to look ahead and know, okay, in this month, you know, this time of year, we can expect this amount of revenue, rather than, you know, the sort of ups and downs that can come from the push at the end of the year, for example, in December, when people are looking to get tax receipts or they feel that sense of generosity coming upon them. So monthly giving is really one of the best ways to engage with any organization.
Absolutely. And obviously people can find out how to do that through the website, right?
Sure, yep. Centralpalroulant.org/donate.
Okay.
Any amount really makes all the difference.
Nice. And that's part of your role, right? You're fundraising and communications manager. So
yeah, for sure. But I have a hand in
everything,
a bit of everything. We just had a little volunteer Sanka set the other night. It was a really great chance to just have one-on-one conversations with volunteers I knew, some that I didn't. Actually make connections between people. Hey, so-and-so, have you met so-and-so? That's one of my favorite elements of the job, actually, is those social connections.
And would you say, I mean, obviously the organization began in a particular neighborhood in Montreal, which I guess was the Plateau?
I believe so, yeah. And then we expanded. So at the moment we have 8 different neighborhoods that we serve, essentially all around the Mount Royal, all the way to Côte des Neiges, NDG, here in the McGill Ghetto as well, Mile End, Centre-Sud, so 8 different neighborhoods, and about 200 people, more than 200 people receive the meals every year. So most of them on an ongoing basis, and many, you know, 5 days a week.
Wow. And I guess there are people that have received the meals for like a long time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, some folks, very long time. I don't know. There was one woman receiving our meals. She'd been receiving them for about 10 years. So we do have some people who receive them over the long term. And they really, you know, they're beloved. They're really strong members of the community.
And is there a side to the organization that tries to work with people with special needs, I guess, as well? Or
yeah, we have are developing some partnerships to actually get people with particular accessibility needs involved in the volunteer program, actually. So in kitchen shifts, these can often be spaces that for accessibility reasons are not accessible. So they're offering, I would struggle to say the organization's shorthand name even. It's like the L'Institut pour
adaptabilité or something like that.
It's a very long one. But we have partnerships like that we're developing more and more and more to make sure that people can get involved. It's a sense of inclusion for them, they themselves, to be able to give back to their communities, to develop a relationship with an organization, to develop relationships with other people. You know, in the kitchen, we have particular infrastructure to allow somebody to sit down or to sit in a wheelchair. That kind of accessible infrastructure has been a priority for us over the last few years. We even have an elevator up to the rooftop garden. We have garden beds that people in wheelchairs can still sit in and do some gardening. So, you know, that's part of the dream for the farm as well, is to make sure that we're incorporating more and more of that accessible infrastructure so that people can participate regardless of their level of mobility or any challenges that they face.
Nice. And do you have any kind of events, like a major event coming up before the winter, I guess, in the late summer, early fall?
Events are a big part of what we do at the Roulant. You can imagine if we're all about community building, social inclusion. So we just had our major event in July. But coming up, and this is particularly interesting for those who are curious about the spaces we've been talking about today, on September 2nd, we have a community farm day. So it's a bit of a collective volunteering experience and potluck lunch. So we're calling it the Power Weed. So September 2nd, it's a Friday. And there's more information about that on the website in the news section.
In the daytime, obviously.
In the daytime, yes, exactly. So from morning and then a picnic lunch. And then we have two visits coming up of the La Cité Garden, actually. It'll be run for us by the museum hosts. So we're actually going to, you know, even some of the members of the staff are going to be interested in going on that tour, because we're going to be able to go see the crypts, actually. There is a crypt of, the nuns past, essentially.
Okay.
So we'll have two opportunities of that tour. So seeing the gardens and that area. But the best way to hear about all of these events is to sign up for our newsletter. And we've actually got one going out this week.
Okay.
So you can sign up centrepelleroulant.org/newsletter. And we only send out about once a month, so it's a lot of really good information. We share about upcoming events, ways to get involved, and it's just an invitation to you to become part of the Roulant community.
Nice. Well, I think we're out of time, but we'll give the website one more time. It's centrepelleroulant.org. And there's tons of information there. And I think you're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter as well. And you're probably easy to find that way as well.
Yeah. But still, the best way to keep in touch with us is that newsletter.
Newsletter. Yeah. That's great. Well, thank you so much, Melanie, for joining us on the show and all this great information. So we've been talking to Melanie Godel, who is the Communications and Fundraising Manager for Centrepelleroulant. You have been listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. We're going to play some ads and a little bit of music before we bid you farewell here on this Tuesday. But you can always follow us on Facebook by going to facebook.com/EcolibriumCKUT Montreal. We have a little website, which is equilibriumradio.weebly.com. You can email us with any comments or suggestions at equilibrium@ckut.ca. So thanks for listening, and as I said, we'll leave you with some ads and probably a little bit of music from Bruce Colbert. All the best. Enjoy the rest of your day.
CKUT's Ill Groove Garden will be hosting our 25-year anniversary Sunday, August the 21st.
Special live radio broadcast from 9 p.m. to 1 a.m. from Blue Dog, 3958 Saint Laurent. Salute to Ill Groove Garden Foundation, D Hybrid, Manchel, Bite, and Ziplocs.
Current DJs DJ Blaster and DJ Mystical Flex.
Big up DJ Raid, Jesse Walker, Myth Ben, Serious Savage, Dirty Needle Crew, and the countless guests like Preach, Shogun, Tash, MCD Solo, and many more. Join us live in person at Blue Dog, 3958 Saint Laurent. Vibes with IGG's crew, DJ Blaster, Mystical Flex, and host Ziplocs.
25 years of making your last hour of the week the best hour of the week. So before summer's done, we celebrate with music, performances, interviews, and vibes. Doors open at 8 p.m., live to air at 9 p.m. till 1 in the morning. So come join us live from Montreal's legendary Blue Dog.
3958 Saint Laurent.
That's Ill Groove Garden. 25-year anniversary. Live radio broadcast Sunday, August the 21st. Tune in on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal or www.ckut.ca worldwide.
Hey, you're listening to Ill Groove Garden
90.3 FM.
Hi, I'm David Suzuki, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Information to grow the brain.